New York, this is Democracy Now!
Make no mistake, this left-wing cultural revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. To make this possible, they are determined to tear down every statue, symbol, and memory of our national heritage.
President Trump delivers a divisive address to mark Independence Day at Mount Rushmore while virtually ignoring the coronavirus pandemic, which has killed 130,000 people in the United States, a quarter of the deaths in the world. At least 15 indigenous activists were arrested for blocking traffic to protest Trump's visit to the sacred Black Hills. We'll speak to indigenous historian and activist Nick Estes, then to Egypt for an exclusive interview with Leila Swift, one of Egypt's most outspoken and active advocates for prisoner rights in Egypt. She's now fighting for the release of her son and daughter, both prominent activists, as well as other prisoners amidst the coronavirus outbreak.
There should be massive releases of prisoners. This is the only way to make sure that there is not hundreds of prisoners who will be sick and maybe die. Thousands, actually.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coronavirus cases continue to surge across most of the United States with nearly 2.9 million confirmed cases and 130,000 reported deaths, around one quarter of the global death toll and global infections, though both numbers are believed to be significant undercounts of the true toll. On Sunday, the seven-day average for new cases reached a record high in the United States for the last months. Cases are still on the rise in some of the country's most populous states, including Florida, California, and Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott has reversed course, ordering face coverings to be worn in public across most of Texas. Texas officials, and as well as those in Florida and Arizona, say the state's early reopenings help fuel the explosion in cases. Despite skyrocketing cases, crowds still packed many of the open beaches and coastal cities for the July 4th holiday weekend, sparking further fears of even more spikes. On Sunday, President Trump falsely claimed 99% of coronavirus cases in the U.S. are harmless. This comes as more people close to the Trump administration test positive for COVID-19. Former Republican presidential candidate and Trump ally Herman Cain is being treated in a hospital for the disease. He was present at Trump's June 20th Tulsa rally, where at least 8 campaign staffers tested positive for coronavirus, as well as now a number of Secret Service agents. Kimberly Guilfoyle also tested positive for COVID-19. She's a senior Trump campaign official and partner of Donald Trump Jr. Around the world, where confirmed cases have now topped 11 million, with over 500,000 deaths, other countries are also reversing lockdowns after recording new spikes in coronavirus cases. Australia's closed the border between its two most populous states, New South Wales and Victoria, for the first time in a century. Around 3,000 people across 9 public housing lower blocks in Victoria's capital, Melbourne, have been on strict lockdown since Saturday and have been told they cannot leave their homes until further notice. In Spain, the regions of Galicia and Catalonia have been ordered to lock down. In India, the world's largest temporary hospital to treat coronavirus patients opened in New Delhi. The 10,000-bed hospital opened Sunday as officials reported a record nearly 25,000 new cases and 600 deaths. Mexico topped 30,000 COVID-19 deaths this weekend to overtake France as the country with the fifth highest reported death toll. Brazil, second only to the United States in cases and death toll, surpassed 1.6 million coronavirus cases. In the Persian Gulf, infections in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are on the rise after curfews in both nations were lifted last month. Meanwhile, around 240 medical experts from around the world are asking the World Health Organization to revise its official recommendations based on evidence the coronavirus is airborne and can be transmitted through tiny droplets that linger in the air in closed spaces. At least 15 indigenous activists and allies were arrested in South Dakota Friday after blocking a highway leading to Mount Rushmore, where President Trump gave a divisive speech attacking what he called far-left fascism.
Make no mistake, this left-wing cultural revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. To make this possible, they are determined to tear down every statue, symbol, and memory of our national heritage.
During his Mount Rushmore address, Trump made only a passing reference to the pandemic. Public health officials criticized the White House for not requiring social distancing or masks at the event. Trump gave another divisive speech on July 4th at the White House event, where he compared the, quote, radical left to Nazis. We'll have more on the indigenous protests after headlines with historian Nick Estes. A warning to viewers, this story contains graphic footage. In Seattle, Washington, 24-year-old anti-racist activist Summer Taylor was killed Saturday evening when a driver rammed a crowd of protesters on a closed section of Interstate 5. A second protester was hospitalized in serious condition. The driver fled the scene but was chased down by another protester and arrested. Investigators say they don't have a motive in the killing. Summer Taylor was an animal lover who worked full-time at a Seattle veterinary clinic. In Washington, D.C., protesters marched along the National Mall Saturday to Lafayette Park near the White House ahead of President Trump's 4th of July fireworks event. This is 18-year-old Cherish.
What have they given us? They gave us new laws that just enslaved us under a different name. I'm sick and I'm tired. I'm tired of coming out here to scream this. I want to see change. You know where that starts?
With us.
That starts with us.
In Baltimore, Maryland, protesters toppled a statue of Christopher Columbus Saturday night and threw it in the harbor. The statue stood since 1984 when it was dedicated by then-President Ronald Reagan. In Georgia, heavily armed protesters, most of them African-American, marched on Stone Mountain Park on the 4th of July, demanding the removal of a massive carving of Confederate leaders from the side of the mountain. In Des Moines, Iowa, hundreds of people rallied at the state capitol Saturday demanding the removal of monuments glorifying white supremacy, including a statue depicting an indigenous person seated below a white pioneer. In Portland, Oregon, police declared a 4th of July protest a riot and fired tear gas to clear demonstrators, some of whom fired commercial-grade fireworks at a federal courthouse in a downtown jail. At least 13 people were arrested. Meanwhile, in Colorado, three officers with the Aurora Police Department were fired, a fourth resigned, after they staged a photo reenacting the killing of Elijah McClain, an African-American man who died after an officer put him in a chokehold as he attempted to walk home from a store last August. Aurora's interim police chief, Vanessa Wilson, called the photo a crime against humanity and decency. No officers have been arrested in the death of Elijah McClain. In sports news, pressure is growing on the Washington Redskins to change its racist name. On Thursday, FedEx, which holds the naming rights for the team's football stadium, called on the team to come up with a new name. Nike has also pulled gear for the team from its store. The team has announced it's undergoing a, quote, thorough review of the team's name. Meanwhile, in baseball news, Cleveland Indians manager Terry Francona has changing the team's name. On Sunday, he said, quote, I think it's time to move forward. In Ethiopia. Over 160 people have been killed during unrest following the murder of popular singer and activist Hachalu Hundessa last Monday. He was a member of the ethnic Oromo group and had once served 5 years behind bars as a political prisoner. His music became the soundtrack to anti-government protests that swept Ethiopia and led to the resignation of its prime minister in 2018 and the appointment of Abiy Ahmed, the country's first Oromo leader. At least 5 people have been arrested in connection with Hundessa's killing. China continues its crackdown on Hong Kong days after it enacted its national security law last Tuesday. Books from pro-democracy activists have been removed from Hong Kong libraries so that they can be reviewed for possible violations of the law, which criminalizes what it calls acts of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces, unquote. On Friday, a 23-year-old man became the first person to be charged under the new law after he rode a motorcycle into police while carrying a sign that read, "Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times," a slogan which is now banned. At a protest Monday, Hong Kong residents held up blank pieces of paper to protest the legislation and censorship.
These slogans will always be in my heart. And those words will always stay on white paper, which will never disappear. They can silence us, create white terror, and let us censor ourselves, but our heart will never die.
Prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy figure and former lawmaker Nathan Law said he fled Hong Kong to an undisclosed location following the signing of the law. Nathan Law testified before the U.S. House last week and told supporters he would continue the struggle from outside Hong Kong. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has signed a so-called anti-terror bill into law, further consolidating his authoritarian power. Critics say the law could be used to silence all forms of dissent and threaten civil liberties. Human Rights Watch said the law, quote, pushes Philippine democracy into an abyss. Opponents say they'll challenge the law in court. Rescue operations continued in Burma over the weekend following a deadly landslide at a jade mine that killed over 170 people. The tragic incident is shining a spotlight on the secretive, often illegal practices of the jade industry, which human rights group Global Witness says fuels armed conflict between government troops and rebel fighters seeking self-rule in northern Burma. Back in the United States, the family of Vanessa Guillen, the 20-year-old Fort Hood soldier who's been missing since April, says military investigators have positively identified her remains. The remains were found last week in a shallow grave near the Texas Army base. Army investigators told the family Guillen was beaten to death with a hammer before being removed from the base. The main suspect in her killing, specialist Aaron David Robinson, died by suicide last week. According to her family, Guillen had been planning on reporting Robinson for sexual harassment. To see our interview with the Guillen family lawyer, Natalie Kawam, go to democracynow.org. The killings of 17-year-old black transgender teen Brayla Stone and 22-year-old black trans woman Mercy Mack mark at least the 17th and 18th violent deaths of transgender people in the U.S. so far this year. Brayla Stone's body was found in a car in a suburb of Little Rock, Arkansas, June 25th. Her death is now being investigated as a homicide after a man reportedly claimed on social media he'd been paid $5,000 to kill her. An 18-year-old suspect was arrested last week. Mercy Mack was found June 30th in Dallas, Texas, with a gunshot wound to the head. Mack had recently posted on Facebook that she was excited to return to her job at a restaurant that had been closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. The FBI has arrested Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite who's accused of luring girls to be sexually abused by convicted predator and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Maxwell is scheduled to appear in a New York court this week and could face up to 35 years behind bars. Epstein died from an apparent suicide last August in his jail cell. Maxwell has also previously been accused of sexually assaulting girls along with Epstein. In related news, the New York Times is reporting lawyers for Prince Andrew Andrew spoke with a Washington lobbyist who has ties to the Trump administration about assisting Prince Andrew with the fallout from his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The lobbyist, Robert Strick, reportedly did not feel comfortable representing the prince, and no deal was made. Prince Andrew was a close friend of Epstein's and has been accused of being involved in Epstein's sex trafficking crimes and having sex with one of Epstein's survivors when she was 17 years old. Prince Andrew is the son of Queen Elizabeth. Prior to Trump firing him last month, former U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman had been heading up investigations into Epstein's co-conspirators. Trump had been a longtime friend of Jeffrey Epstein. And in environmental news, Duke Energy and Dominion Energy have canceled plans to build the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in a major victory for indigenous and environmental activists who've opposed the project since it was announced in 2014. The 600-mile pipeline would have carried frack gas from West Virginia to North Carolina, passing under the Appalachian Trail in Virginia's George Washington National Forest. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As many marked this year's 4th of July weekend by staying home to stop the spread of COVID-19, President Donald Trump hosted two back-to-back events in South Dakota and at the White House over the weekend, where he stoked racial divisions, attacked Black Lives Matter protesters, defended statues of colonizers and white supremacists, and falsely claimed that 99% of coronavirus cases in the United States are, quote, harmless. Despite the warnings of public health officials and a U.S. death toll of nearly 130,000, a quarter of the deaths in the world, few wore masks at both Trump events. At Mount Rushmore, a crowd of thousands did not socially distance. At least 15 indigenous activists and allies were arrested after blocking a highway heading to the rally. Mount Rushmore is a monument carved into the sacred Black Hills on unceded Lakota territory. It was designed by a sculptor with ties to the Ku Klux Klan. The president of the Oglala Sioux tribe had ordered Trump to cancel Friday's event. This is President Trump addressing the crowd of thousands in front of Mount Rushmore Friday.
Make no mistake, this left-wing cultural revolution is designed to overthrow the American Revolution. To make this possible, they are determined to tear down every statue, symbol and memory of our national heritage.
And this is President Trump speaking in Washington, D.C. Saturday, where he compared the, quote, radical left to Nazis.
We are now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing. In every age, there have always been those who seek to lie about the past in order to gain power in the present. Those that are lying about our history, those who want us to be ashamed of who we are not interested in justice or in healing. Their goal is demolition. Our goal is not to destroy the greatest structure on earth, what we have built.
The same day of Trump's White House address, protesters in Baltimore, Maryland, pulled down a statue of Christopher Columbus. They then dragged the statue several blocks and dumped it into the city's harbor. For more, we go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we're joined by Nick Estes, citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux tribe, assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Estes. It's great to have you with us. Let's talk about the significance of this moment that President Trump chose to seize on. July 3rd, in honor of Independence Day, he goes to Mount Rushmore, named for a gold speculator, a New York attorney. Designed by a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan. Even as leaders of indigenous nations in the United States demanded he not come to the Black Hills. Talk about the significance of Mount Rushmore for indigenous people and that whole area.
Good morning, Amy. Yes, this is a very kind of important history to talk about because, as you mentioned in the news brief, the Black Hills, or what we know as Hesapa, is the cultural kind of like center of our universe's Lakota people. But more than 50 different indigenous nations actually have origin stories or ties or spiritual connections to the Black Hills. And the Lakota people, as well as the Cheyenne and Arapaho people, when they signed the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, became the caretakers of that land. And so back in 1980, there was a Supreme Court decision that ruled that the Black Hills itself had been illegally taken from the Lakota Nation, and that the Supreme Court itself could only reward a monetary compensation, because the courts can't actually award land back to the tribes. And so since 1980, the tribes have been refusing to accept money for, they can't put a price tag on the Black Hills. So they've been refusing to accept money. But at the same time, the Black Hills themselves has become a hot spot of the kind of cultural war that Trump is trying to stir up across the nation. For example, there are about 2 million visitors per year that go to Mount Rushmore. And with the kind of new guidelines about social distancing, we can see that this is only further exacerbating the COVID-19 pandemic and tribes' responses to it. And so when Trump announced that he was coming to this particular area, he wasn't invited by the tribes. The tribes actually asked him to seek an invitation to respect their sovereignty. And if you listen to the audio clip, not once does he mention the fact that the tribes, you know, opposed his visit there. So this is a very contentious issue for Lakota people.
All of the protesters who were arrested in South Dakota Friday have been released, except for Nick Tilson, who we interviewed Friday, president of the NDN Collective and a citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, currently being held without bond. This is what he had to say on our broadcast.
This is an act of violence and aggression against us, and it's also pushing this falsehood narrative about American democracy when we actually really should be uplifting the truths of what happened throughout history and how those truths are directly connected to the disparities that exist today in society amongst indigenous people.
So that's Nick Tilson from an illustrious indigenous family, his great-grandmother, Merida LeSueur, his grandfather, his parents, all deeply active in indigenous rights activism, his parents leading a march that was one of the largest in the Black Hills region in the early 80s. Only larger was what the Ku Klux Klan march there in the 1920s. Do you have the latest news on Nick Tilson and why he alone is continuing to be held? Nick Estes?
Yeah. So, first of all, the arrests that happened of those 15 people at the blockade, they were treaty defenders, right? And so when Trump is talking about erasing history, he's actually suppressing history. The people who were arrested at this particular blockade were arrested because they were representing the true histories, right? And so Nick Tilson was charged with several things. One of them is a serious charge. It's a second degree robbery charge, which in the state of South Dakota is a class 4 felony, which is punishable up to 10 years in prison. He appears this morning in several hours at about 10 a.m. Mountain Standard Time before a judge. And has yet to be seen whether or not, you know, Tilson himself will be charged with the new riot boosting laws that Kristi Noem signed into law earlier this year, something that Nick himself has successfully sued the state of South Dakota over in the past. And the courts have sided with him, saying that it is a violation of First Amendment rights. The state went back and rewrote the laws. But now it's a question about whether or not, you know, he's going to be charged with these new riot boosting laws that were created and drafted, you know, in preparation for the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, something that NDN Collective and Nick himself has been adamantly opposed to because it violates, again, the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, because it trespasses through the heart of our treaty lands and skirts around two major reservations, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, as well as the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. So it's important to remember that already the state of South Dakota, it has one of the highest rates of incarceration of Native people. They're about 10%. We're about 10% of the state's population, but we make up about 30% of the jail population. And in a place like Pennington County, where Nick's being held right now, I think it's around 50 to 75% jail population are Native right now. So this is more than just about his arrest at Mount Rushmore. It's about a long-standing treaty claim. And I think Nick would agree with me on this, that this is about treaty rights, right? He's a treaty defender, and it's unclear why all 15 other protesters were released, but not Nick himself.
I wanted to go back to this history because a number of people seem surprised by the whole history of Mount Rushmore, you know, having the four sculpted heads of Presidents Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt blasted out of the ancient granite between 1927 and 1941 by 400 workers directed by Goodson Borglum. Earlier, he was recruited by the Daughters of the Confederacy to carve the huge stone mountain memorial to Confederate leaders in Georgia. He left that project in a dispute, but that allowed him to hone his mountain carving skills, enabling the Rushmore Monument. Borglum, close to the KKK, might even have been a member of the KKK. And this weekend, also the March on Stone Mountain by leaders demanding it be taken down. The connection between Stone Mountain and Mount Rushmore, and who is carved into the ancient granite, Nick Estes, and what he means in indigenous history, what
right.
they mean.
So it's important to remember that Stone Mountain was a meeting place for the Ku Klux Klan. It's actually where the Klan reformed and reconstituted itself at a particular moment in time. So that site was chosen because of that particular significance. And so while there's speculation about, you know, whether or not Goodson Borglum himself was, you know, a member of the Klan, is not as important as the fact that, like, he's creating these symbols at a time of, you know, Jim Crow segregation laws. When he comes to a place like the Black Hills, this is part of a larger kind of effort to intimidate and also to lay claim on the Black Hills in spite of these treaty claims, right? So if we look at the more recent history, so for example, on June 25th, Dusty Johnson, who is a Republican congressman, introduced a bill to prevent the destruction of Mount Rushmore, the renaming of the mountain or the monument itself. But in that bill, it says nothing of the Fort Laramie Treaty. The very document that was, you know, that was signed in 1868 to protect the Black Hills for the Lakota people in perpetuity. And why would Dusty Johnson, you know, I'm a historian, there's no coincidences in dates, right? Why would Dusty Johnson choose June 25th as the date that he introduces this bill to protect this symbol of white supremacy? Well, for Lakota people, for Cheyenne and Arapaho people, we celebrate June 25th as Victory Day, because in 1876, an alliance of Lakota, Dakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho defeated Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn, or the Battle of Greasy Grass, and that was a victory that was kind of mounted against the United States right before it tried to celebrate its 100-year anniversary of signing of the Declaration of Independence, a document that was written by Thomas Jefferson, who's one of the figures who wrote in that document, merciless Indian savages, to describe indigenous people. And it's important to note that on that date that Trump read his speech at Mount Rushmore, he said, "Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to wipe out our history, defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children we don't think it's coincidence that he used that language, the same language that Thomas Jefferson used. It's also important to note that, you know, George Washington was named town destroyer by the Haudenosaunee Confederacy for his scorched earth campaigns against the Iroquois nation prior to the revolution, but also during the Revolutionary War itself. Abraham Lincoln was responsible for multiple things, such as the passage of the Morrell Act, which created modern land-grant universities that used dispossessed indigenous land to create the modern university system, as well as the 1862 Homestead Act, which carved out 270 million acres of indigenous territory and basically gave it away for free to white families. And it categorically excluded, of course, indigenous and black folks as well. But also he oversaw the 1862 hanging of 38 Dakota patriots in the state of Minnesota, as well as the Navajo Long Walk, which imprisoned Navajo people as well as Apache people at Bosque Redondo, and oversaw also the, you know, he was the commander in chief when the Colorado militias massacred the Cheyenne people at Sand Creek in 1864. And then lastly, you know, the bust of Teddy Roosevelt is incredibly important because he's kind of seen as the father of the modern kind of conservation movement and the creation of national parks. Well, for this settler nation to enjoy nature, indigenous people had to be removed from it. And so he carved out millions of acres in what we now know as the kind of national monuments, the natural monuments or the natural wonders of the West, the iconic kind of vistas of the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone National Park. Those were created under Teddy Roosevelt's watch, but it was also under his watch that they removed indigenous peoples from these lands so that white settlers could enjoy them in peace.
And Nick Estes, we're going to break and then come back. I want to ask you about a number of issues, COVID in South Dakota and other places, for example, where you are in New Mexico, the standoff with the governor of South Dakota, Trump ally, Governor Noem, going after indigenous leaders for setting up checkpoints to check for COVID, and about the renaming of the sports teams from the Redskins to the Cleveland Indians. Stay with us. This is Nick Estes. He's a professor at University of New Mexico. But I keep my knife at my side. I will pray for compassion. Whoa-oh. But if war comes to my door, you know I will be blasting warrior mentality, my responsibility, bringing it to my people now. Holler if you're feeling me, feeling me, feeling me, feeling me, feeling me, yeah. Feeling me, feeling me, feeling me, feeling me, yeah. Can I make my situation? My situation, I come from a long line of people in displacement. I am an Indian. I'm a warrior people by Nakro and Medicine for the People. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, the Quarantine Report. As we talk about Trump's visit to Mount Rushmore and his visit to and his White House event, the Rushmore event came months of escalating coronavirus infections in Native communities. There was no social distancing. The governor proudly announced this. 7,500 people packed into the area under Mount Rushmore. No one was required to wear masks. Nick Estes is our guest, a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. In the last months, there has been a showdown between indigenous leaders in South Dakota and Trump ally, South Dakota Governor Noem, around the issue of COVID. Talk about how hard hit Indian country is by the coronavirus, Nick.
Right. So Kristi Noem, like many of her counterparts, you know, in the Republican Party, have taken a hallucination-based approach to the COVID-19 pandemic, and believing that if they just stick to their, you know, conservative right-wing values and blame somebody else, such as China or whatever, that this will just be like a headache and it'll go away after a while. But tribes, you know, ironically enough, have taken a science-based approach. They believe the science because they understand that Indian Health Services, or IHS, which are federal responsibilities by the federal government to provide Indian health services because of treaties or other kinds of agreements, are chronically underfunded. And in fact, you know, on May 20th of this year, there were five tribal organizations that signed a letter to David Bernhardt, the Secretary of Interior. You know, he's a former oil lobbyist, calling for the resignation of current Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Tara Sweeney over several things, but primarily the mishandling of the $8 billion that were allocated under the CARES Act money for tribal coronavirus relief. And what their claims kind of set out is that the federal government has used this particular moment as an opportunity to facilitate land grabs, you know. So on one hand, you know, the federal court denied the Mashpee Wampanoag the right to restore their own homelands. That has since been reversed. But that was a process that was set in motion by Sweeney herself back in 2018. Her office also failed to protect the Tohono O'odham Nation's burial and sacred sites from being destroyed by explosives to build Trump's border wall, the construction of which, as we know, has continued unabated despite the pandemic. And meanwhile, the Interior Department also allowed for-profit Alaska Native corporations, many of which have investments in oil and gas industry, to seek payouts from the COVID-19 relief money reserved for tribal governments. So it's unclear how that determination was made, but it has been since ruled by the courts that Alaska Native corporations will receive tribal money. But at the same time, The governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, is pushing for the TC Energy pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, to be constructed through tribal reservation lands. Meanwhile, the tribes themselves have set up health checkpoints. And, it's important to note that they're not turning people away. They're not armed checkpoints. You know, they're just doing health and safety checkpoints for people coming on and off the reservation. And it's an attempt to basically implement safety protocols that the state itself and Trump himself refuses to implement. And this is all leading up to the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. And while it's been reported, and rightfully so, that this pipeline is bringing in thousands of outside workers, out-of-state workers, into these, you know, very precarious tribal communities, and there's concern about man camps and the high rates of sexual violence, but now the threat has been doubled with the threat of, you know, spreading coronavirus to these already hard-hit tribal
communities.
Interestingly,
after enormous pressure, Dominion and Duke have announced they're ending the Atlantic Coast pipeline. But I wanted to go quickly, before we end in this last minute, to the pressure on the Washington Redskins to change their racist name. I'm even sorry that I use the word on air. and I wanted to ask you about what that means. It's often talked about as a change of heart. This one, that FedEx is pushing for it. They own the stadium. And the Cleveland Indians, the fact that the manager is now talking about changing that name. Again, of course, it's all coming from enormous pressure from below for years.
Yeah, we really owe it to activists such as Suzanne Schoen Harjo and Amanda Blackhorse, who have been at the forefront of this, facing not just racial discrimination from, you know, billionaire team owners like Dan Snyder, who owns the Washington football team, but also sexist attacks against them because they're Native American women. We can see this is tied into the kind of gendered violence that Native women face on a daily basis in this country. And I'll say, you know, whether it's Suzanne Schoen Harjo or whether it's Amanda Blackhorse, they're not just advocating for the changing of the names, right? We could see this in the Lando Lake Butter maiden, who she, you know, it was a joke going around Indian country where it's like, well, they removed the Indian, but they kept the land, right? So we're actually talking about land back. We're actually talking about upholding treaty rights for indigenous people. And this is what these activists, you know, primarily indigenous women, have been advocating all along. So it's an incredibly important step in the right direction.
And very quickly, Professor Estes, In Baltimore, the taking down of the Christopher Columbus statue and throwing him into the harbor. If you can, in a minute, tell us who Christopher Columbus was.
So it's really funny because somebody like Trump said that Christopher Columbus represents the American dream, the beginning of the American dream. Christopher Columbus, you know, landed in a Caribbean island that he thought was India, and he thought it was his dying breath, and he never stepped foot on the continent that later became the United States of America. So why he's celebrated as a figure has to do with the fact that he enslaved, raped, and tortured indigenous people, and he himself was a genocider. And that's the legacy that somebody like Trump wants to uphold when he's creating these monument statues or he's issuing executive orders for the protection of the so-called heritage of this country. It's a heritage of conquest and theft.
Nick Estes, I want to thank you for being with us, citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe, assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, speaking to us from Albuquerque. When we come back, we go to Egypt for an exclusive interview. Stay with us. Ennio Morricone's theme of Ali from the Battle of Algiers. Morricone passed away today at the age of 91. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Egypt, where coronavirus infections are continuing to rise, threatening to overwhelm the healthcare system. As the government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi grapples with the pandemic, it's cracked down, arresting doctors, journalists, lawyers who dare to speak out. Today, we take a look at one family who's been particularly targeted, arguably the most prominent activist family in Egypt. But first, we go to Cairo to speak with Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous about the coronavirus crackdown, it being used as a pretext for arrests, to talk about the interview that he did. Hi, Sharif. Talk about what's happening right now in Egypt.
Well, Amy, as you mentioned, over the past few months, as the coronavirus has spread in Egypt, the state's been trying even more viciously than usual to control the message and to clamp down on any real or even perceived opposition. So, as you mentioned, dozens of people have been arbitrarily arrested, including at least 10 doctors who are being increasingly targeted, six journalists, lawyers, activists, and so on. And also, as the country went into a partial lockdown in March, the Ministry of Interior suspended all prison visitations for the families of detainees. So prisoners have largely been cut off from their families for the last 4 months. And unlike nearly every other country in the Middle East, Egypt has not released thousands of prisoners as a precaution against the coronavirus. Instead, it's arrested more people and cut off communication. Among the leading voices for prisoner rights in Egypt is the Saif family. The eldest son, Ali Abdel Fattah, was a leading figure of the 2011 revolution. He was released from prison last year after serving a 5-year sentence on trumped-up charges. During his brief time out, he had an additional 5 years of probation where he had to submit himself to a police station for 12 hours every day from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. He was rearrested in September, and he remains behind bars in pretrial detention. Now, Ali's mother, Leila Swaif, and his two sisters, Mona and Sanaa, have been tireless advocates for Ali and for prisoners in general. They've constantly challenged prison authorities, challenged the judicial system to fight for the rights of Ali and other prisoners. They've gone on hunger strikes, have done actions, they've raised awareness, they're constantly speaking out, and all of them have been arrested at different times for their activism. In 2014, both Ali and Sanaa were in prison at the same time, and their father, the prominent human rights lawyer Ahmed Saif, died of a heart condition while they were inside. Just this past March, Leila and Mona were arrested and released the next day after holding a small protest to call for the release of prisoners amid the coronavirus outbreak. And then as prison visitations were suspended, communication cut off, they stepped up their actions. And this kind of came to a head 2 weeks ago when Sanaa and Mona and Leila were physically assaulted after spending the night outside the prison, demanding that authorities allow them to receive a letter from Alaa. Sana in particular was very badly beaten. And when they went to the public prosecutor's office the next day, Sana was forcibly taken by plainclothes security forces. Prosecutors later, a few hours later, ordered her to be imprisoned for 15 days in pretrial detention, an order that can be renewed for months or even years. And Sana, who's only 26, has already spent over a year and a half in prison in two separate cases. So now
Sharif,
both Alaa and Sana are in prison at the same time. And I sat down with Leila Swaif a couple of days ago to talk about
all
this.
So let's go to this interview, this first broadcast exclusive interview that you did with her since her daughter Sana's arrest.
Thank you for joining us, Leila Swaif. Your daughter Sana was arrested nearly 2 weeks ago. The prosecution ordered Sana to be held in pretrial detention for 15 days. Yes. Do you expect her to be getting out anytime soon?
I hope so. You can never tell. It's possible that they will just continue to renew her. But it is also possible that because of all the circumstances around her arrest, that it will not just go into this routine of just renewing. I think it really depends on how much of a headache we can create for the prosecutor. Maybe if we can create a large enough headache about the fact that this is a cover-up for a kidnap, maybe she will be released. I'm not sure.
Two of your three children, Sana and Alaa, are now in prison. This has happened before in 2014. What's it like for you now that they're both once again locked up?
It hasn't sunk in that Sana is actually in prison. It's like, like she went away for a while. I have to remember to walk her dog, feed her dog. I think... I suppose it's going to be like before, except, okay, the first time was very tough because my husband was very sick and he went into coma and he died while they were in prison. It was really, really tough. And I think, I said about Sana a little while ago that she managed her imprisonment. But she, what really hit her was losing her father while she was in prison. That hit her. That hit her, and that has left scars that show to this day suddenly there are times when it just all comes out. And yes, hopefully nobody's going to die while in prison this time. Hopefully. So let's hope, it won't be such a traumatic experience.
When's the last time you spoke to Alaa?
Just a week before the lockdown. Like, it was 2 March, 3 March, something like that.
So, about 4 months ago.
Yes.
Is that the longest time you haven't heard your son's voice?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And even when he was working in South Africa, I think we talked on the phone like once a week or something. I used to get these horrible bills.
Well, how's that experience that you can't hear his voice, that there's just communication through a letter once in a while?
With Alaa in particular, it's very tough because Alaa is the person I talk with. Alaa is the person I talk with about science fiction novels and the stupidity of people who don't understand the probability and probabilistic dangers. And Alaa is the person I talk with, so. 4 months without talking to Alaa, it's really...
You and your family have consistently been trying to put pressure on authorities. You've been arrested, you've been physically assaulted. Do you ever get afraid of the repercussions? I mean, what gives you strength to keep doing this?
I'm always afraid of the repercussions. Nobody can be not, cannot, particularly as the repercussions fall on other people. Maybe I'm not that afraid about, I'm 64, it doesn't matter what happens to me anymore anyway. But I'm certainly afraid of what can happen to my daughters. When we were arrested, I was afraid for Hadef and Rabab. I was afraid. But I think we can't even give up because Ali is in prison. You can't decide, okay, I'm going to stop. How can I stop? Ali is in prison. And when Ali was out of prison, he was in this horrible muraqaba thing where he had to spend the night, every night in the police station, etc. And he's not. So you actually don't have an option. And the option of not doing anything is not there. This is not a regime which will allow, which will leave you alone if you're quiet. And I've learned during my life that what if there's something that where you don't have an option, you just do it the best way you can. This is long training. You translate things to actual actions. You don't sit down and think about the consequences. You don't sit down and think about the years that are flying by. You just translate it into practical tasks and you finish the tasks. Like, I have to finish the dishes, I have to finish this petition, for Nabil Ayam, etc.
Your family has had long and difficult experience with prisons in Egypt, and two of your children are now in prison. How has all of this affected your family?
It's put all, in a way, it's put all of our careers on hold. Mona should by now have done a PhD. She hasn't. I'm still a university professor, as I still teach, but I haven't managed to do research for years now. You sort of are forced into becoming a full-time human rights activist, which we actually are not. The only one who was a human rights lawyer was Saif, my husband. I'm a professor of mathematics. Ale is a software developer. Mona is a biologist. Sana is a film editor. But you end up, doing all this around your other things.
So what are you calling for now?
I'm still calling for what I called for when I stood outside Majlis al-Wuzara and was arrested, that because of COVID-19, there should be massive releases of prisoners. This is the only way to make sure that there is not hundreds of prisoners who will be sick and maybe die and so on. And there are thousands, actually. But this is the initial demand. In the meantime, while this is not happening, prisons should not be locked down. There should be either the visits should be reopened, or at least there should be telephone calls, stuff like that. And finally, Taban, I'm demanding the release of Ale and Sana because they are both on pre-trial detention, and these are only the urgent demands. We need the authorities to take COVID-19 seriously. We need authorities to spend money on hospitals, on doctors, on protecting doctors. We need the authorities to stop arresting doctors who talk about the problems of COVID-19, many things.
Sana had said that she had lost hope for change. What about you? What gives you hope?
What is happening now, nightmarish as it is change. I have lived very long time. I keep saying there's a very big difference between being part of a popular movement that is in retreat and that has been vanquished, and being part of a very small elitist movement, which is how things were from the 80s to 2011. For me, even this nightmarish situation is change. The fact that I get thousands of people talking about Aliyah, the fact that this is completely the fact that I get the fact that when we even when we talk about a very controversial issue homophobia or whatever, we get thousands of supporters. None of this. I compare to the past. I compare this to the first time Saif took up a case, the Queen Boat case, a case about homosexuals. And nobody, and he had to fight with human rights lawyers. Okay, now no human rights lawyer would say, no, this shouldn't be this case. At that time, nobody would touch it. Almost nobody. I sincerely believe that part of the viciousness of this regime is the fact that it feels outstripped by events.
What do you mean?
Everything, yani. So the so many people are making jokes about them. So many people are, so many young people are doing things that nobody imagined before. So, yani, they're trying to curb all that viciously. Look at the doctors. Okay, they arrest the doctor because he's talked about corona. Next day, there is another doctor who's talking about condition. They are being very vicious, but actually they are not managing to control things. And I think the part of the viciousness is that. Okay, so there is a difference. There is a very, I can see it in young people. They are angry. They are not. They are put upon, but they are not accepting it lying down. For me, a change has happened, and this change will have to bear fruit at some point.
But many people are disheartened and feel demoralized by what's happening now, both in Egypt and some places abroad as well. You seem to strike a more hopeful tone.
All these authorities who are disheartening us, like Sisi and like Trump, and like anyone can see that they are not going to get a stable system. Okay, and you can have an unstable system that goes on for a long time, but it's not. It's never. One can see. Anyone can see that it's never going to be a stable system. There are always chances in an unstable system. There are always chances. You might be able to make use of them, you might not, but there are always chances.
Are you following the mass protest movement against police violence in the U.S., and how does it resonate for you?
Sure. I've always thought, since 2011, I've always thought that what we have, what is being born, is an international movement against authoritarianism, against this kind of thing. And that there is a difference, but it's only a difference in quality, not in quantity, not in quality, between police in the States and police in Egypt and, I don't know, police in England. At least in France. These are the countries I know. I'm glad that people are rising. I'm hoping that I say, every time I see people rise against authoritarianism, against police brutality, anywhere in the world, this gives me hope, because I to me, for me, this is a movement that has to happen all over the world.
That's Leila Swift, mathematics professor and mother of Alaa and Saneh. She was interviewed by Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous in Cairo, Egypt. An online petition has been launched at change.org calling on Egypt's attorney general to release prisoners being held in pretrial detention and to allow Alaa Abdel Fattah and other prisoners to communicate with their families and for the release of Sanaa Seif. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask and stay safe.